Hey gang, I'm Nikki LaCroce, and you're listening to Who the Fuck? A show that explores the power of human connection and the profound resilience of the human spirit through compassionate conversations that help you better understand yourself so you can live with the sense of peace, purpose, and joy that you deserve. Each episode offers a safe space for guests to share intimate details of their personal journey and lessons learned along the way as we all seek to answer life's most important question. Who the fuck am I? Hey gang, I'm Nikki LaCroce and you're listening to Who the Fuck. And on today's episode, I'm sharing the mic with Steve Wilson. And Steve's the author of Teetering on a Tightrope, a memoir that recounts his journey through bipolar disorder and how he's coped with mental trauma throughout his life. Steve's diagnosis made a resounding effect on his life, and through his experiences, Steve has taken the opportunity to educate and support others who face mental health challenges so they can also experience a full and productive life. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Of course. When we had our introduction call, one of the things that really stood out to me was just your passion for helping other people navigate through their diagnoses. And because, you know, for anybody who's not watching this, they might not have a frame of reference for your age. You were diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 28 in 1978. So this is not the same type of timeline that we're talking about with people today. Mental health was not what it is now. And certainly there's room for growth at this point too. But can you share a little bit about sort of where your journey started and how you came to a point in your life where you recognized that you needed to learn more about what you were experiencing that ultimately led to your diagnosis?
Okay. Well, unfortunately, my journey began at age 9. I went to the movies on a Saturday afternoon, and a guy bought me a Coke. And then he enticed me to go into the restroom, and he sexually assaulted me. Something I never at that time had an idea could happen. No one back then ever talked about it. And I was so filled with shame that I caused this that I told nobody for 30 years, not even my wife.
It's so much to hold on to.
Yep. I don't know how I did it, but I completely blocked it out. I never thought about it. Unlike other people who constantly have it on their mind and beating them down, I didn't think about it. I never recognized a guy. I don't even know that I saw his face. So I don't have those recurring nightmares of seeing his face because I just don't know what he looked like. Mm-hmm. But anyway, then about 2 or 3 months after that, the depression began. I was in fourth grade, and I was a stellar student. I was a good athlete. I had a lot of friends. But a couple months after the sexual assault, I fell into a deep depression. Had no idea what was going on. And I felt like I was worthless. I felt like I was a failure. Even at that age, it was awful. Didn't want to play with my friends, didn't do my schoolwork. So it was pretty bad. That was my first encounter with depression, and that lasted for 2 or 3 or 4 months, something like that.
May I ask a question real quick about that? So you're speaking to it, recognizing in the present in which we're speaking that is depression. At the time, did you understand that, or was it understood to your parents or anything like that, that was a depressive state, or did it just feel like it was a shift in mood?
It was just a shift in mood. I thought it, I had no idea what it was. My parents didn't have a clue. In fact, they didn't have a clue. For the next 10 years.
Okay.
I went around. Now, you got to understand one thing about bipolar and depression. They come in waves. You're not depressed one day and stay that way for the rest of your life. It's up and down, up and down. And it may be down for 2 months and then up for 6 months. You just never know. Mine came in that after my first experience, I was okay for the next 6 months. And that was fourth grade. So into fifth grade and sixth grade, I was doing pretty well. And then it hit me like a rock in seventh grade. And I went to the bottom. And I didn't have suicidal ideations at the time that I remember, but everything else was pretty bad. And it continued that way up and down all through junior high and high school and college. It began to be really terrible at the end of my college days. I went into a deep, deep depression, started having suicidal ideations. I was a good swimmer. I swam laps every day. And all of a sudden, it started that every stroke I took, my mind from somewhere else would tell me to kill myself. So I went through that. And finally, my mother, after all those years, recognized something was wrong because she had gone through it.
Okay.
And she got me a psychiatrist. And I began talking to him. And in 1972, 14 years after the sexual assault, he diagnosed me with clinical depression. And they started a regimen of medications, and none of them worked. I went into the hospital. And at that time, there were medications, but it was also the belief at the hospital I went to that hard work would put these thoughts out of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So they had me build a rock path through the forest near the hospital. They had me knock down weeds with a sickle. Every time I swung the sickle, my mind from somewhere else would say, kill yourself.
It seems a little counterintuitive to put something that could be weaponized against yourself into the hands of somebody who's depressive.
No, I never even thought of that. You're the first one to bring it up. Never gave it a thought.
Interesting. From the medical professional side, you would think that they might have considered that. I'm glad that it didn't cross your mind, obviously, but it definitely shows disparity in the times, right? That seems like that would be the last thing that somebody would recommend doing at this juncture.
Well, as I said, I never thought about it, but you're right. So I got out of the hospital 3 weeks later. They gave me a regimen of pills to take. None of them worked. They didn't work at all. They made me sick. They made me throw up. They were terrible. That was 1971. And that's when they diagnosed me with depression. And after nothing worked, in 1978, my psychiatrist came to me and he said, I think I made a mistake. I think you are bipolar. Meant nothing to me. I never even heard of bipolar. I doubt if many people heard of bipolar at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So for 6 years, I suffered thinking it was depression. He called it bipolar, and he was right. And at that time, and still today, the go-to drug is lithium, and it worked very well. I got about 50% better, and I began to be able to navigate myself through life. I wasn't cured. There is no cure for bipolar, just like there's no cure for depression. But I got about 50% better so I could function in the world. Up until that point, I hadn't been able to keep a job. I would get angry. I would get fired. I did nothing right. And when I got the lithium, my anger lessened. And I was able to go to work in my family's clothing business in 1978 for the next about 20 years. I was still not very successful because I had a lot of ruminations all the rest of those years. Ruminations are wild thoughts that go through your mind. You can't get them out. They'll keep you from sleeping. They're really horrible. You latch on to something that you think you made a big mistake or that you hurt somebody mentally, something you said, and you can't get it out of your mind.
I understand that. I've dealt with anxiety, and at the peak of my anxiety and dealing with PTSD during my last relationship, the rumination was just incessant. And it was one of the things that I was so grateful in starting therapy was getting to a place where that wasn't just the constant state of existing, because I understand completely. I had troubles with focusing at work during all of that as well.
I made so many mistakes because I couldn't make a decision. It was impossible for me to decide what to do on anything. Later, as my business was around for 85 years. But the last 5 years, because of competition, I just stood around and let it fall apart. I could not get my mind to concentrate on what was at hand. So that was probably, that's one of the worst things about bipolar and depression is your mind just isn't your own for so long. Mm-hmm. Then my psychiatrist died and I got a new psychiatrist. And in the year 2000, he prescribed Paxil. And my ruminations all but went away. Not completely. I still have it today, but about one quarter of what I used to have.
It's so significant.
Yeah. So I was able to start myself out my own business, custom clothing sales throughout Ohio and then Arizona, where I live now, and was very successful at it because I was able to think normally. When I first got the Paxil and my mind settled down, I was able to speak to high school psychology and health classes about teenage depression. And one of the reasons I did that is because we had a young lady who worked for me at my clothing store. We hired her for Christmas help. She was about 15, 16, very bubbly, very cute, had everything going for her. And one Saturday morning, her best friend came in and said that the young lady had taken a gun to bed with her and shot herself in the head.
That's devastating.
Yeah, well, it happened one other time with a young kid, too, just about 5 years before the girl took her life. A friend of mine from college called me. We were pretty close, and his young boy of about somewhere between 13 and 16 had started robbing houses because he got so depressed and he had a drug problem. And he got caught, and they called the parents down to take him from the jail and take him home. As they got there, he pulled out a gun in front of him and shot himself in the head. So I realized at that time that this was an epidemic, and it's gotten so much worse as the pressures have mounted on everybody in this crazy world of ours. And I spoke to those high school classes, found out from many of the students after my speech, I would ask anybody who wanted to come up and talk to me about anything that was bothering them. Mm-hmm. One day, a young lady came up. She was probably the most popular kid in the school. She got all A's. She was an athlete. She was perfect. She came over to me and says, I can't do this anymore. There's so much pressure on me from my parents, the school workers, the teachers, everybody else, that I just can't do it. I'm giving up. I want to kill myself. And then soon after that, a young lady came up and she said, I have no friends. Nobody likes me. I'm ugly. My parents hate me. I hate them. I want to die. So it became apparent at that time, which was somewhere around 2000, something like that, how stressful it is to be a young kid in school. And as I said, it's just gotten worse.
Yeah.
When I came to Arizona, I tried to resume doing that, but the places that did it wouldn't accept me because I was too old. They wanted a peer no older than 35, and I was in my 60s. So I reached out to become a facilitator in a couple mental health support groups, and I've been doing that for the last 8 years here in Phoenix, and it's been a real eye-opener.
So those groups that you facilitate, how did you come to find them and get involved in sort of what's the nature of the group when you're there?
Well, I found the group just happenstance. It was an ad in the paper that they were looking for a facilitator. So I went through some training and they accepted me. And these are groups that are 18 and over. Okay. We don't do kids. They have special groups for kids under 18. I think the most relevant thing I have found out for the last 8 years is that many people come to my group because when they were children, they were either sexually assaulted or physically beaten or mentally destroyed by their parents, whatever. But they, just like me, although I was only assaulted once and they probably had to go through it for years, it screws up your head and you got a lot of problems for the rest of your life. I would say that out of all my two groups that meet each week, at least 20% of them have been raped or beaten, things like that. It's only getting worse.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're shedding a light on, Steve, that I think is really important to acknowledge is the incidence of sexual assault and just domestic assault that happens, that feels to me like it really is pretty ignored. I mean, we talk about the statistics. We know that, let's say 1 in 1,000 rapists is actually penalized in some way for what they've done. And that's based on what's reported, which is about 10% of what's actually happening. Those stats are estimates based on my historic knowledge, but that was roughly what it was a couple of years ago when I had that knowledge ingrained in my brain. And you just think about how you made the comment, this is an epidemic. The lack of accountability for, or even just the lack of any sort of punitive response for people who are taking these actions against vulnerable human beings, whether they're children or adults even, but particularly with children, you know, it is our responsibility as elder human beings to keep the younger human beings safe. And it's so, not only disappointing is an understatement, it's grotesque that we lack the empathy required as a society to put a stop to these things. And I think one of the things where mental health really intersects, it's the people who are perpetuating these violent crimes and then the people who are impacted by these violent crimes. Mental health is an issue for both parties there. It does not excuse the behavior that is violent at all. But most people, as I'm sure you've understood through all the work you've done for yourself and in facilitating these groups, is that the idea of hurt people, right? People who have been abused are more likely to be abusive. And that's a result of things screwing with your head and telling you things that aren't true and then manifesting in these ways that can create more chaos for other people. And I'm oversimplifying it, of course, but it's just, as an empath, it hurts so much to know that these things happen so frequently and it feels like there's virtually nothing being done to stop it.
Well, you can see why it happens so regularly is because statistics will tell you that 20% of the United States and probably the rest of the world, 20% are mentally ill or suffer from bipolar, depression, schizophrenia, whatever. So it is an ongoing program. And one of the things that I have discovered specifically through my facilitating is how terrible our response from the government and organizations is to the mental complexity of mainly those who cannot afford or get the insurance for getting mental health. They slip through the cracks. They get Social Security disability, and they can go to a clinic, but the clinics are so overwhelmed that if a guy is in distress today and he goes and gets help, they'll say, well, we'll see you in a month.
Yeah.
And how the hell can anybody get better if they can't get continuing help? And yeah, they also, in these clinics, cannot prescribe many of the newer and better medications because they're too expensive and the government won't pay for them. And I fault that to the drug companies and the insurance companies.
I 100% agree with you on that. It's profit over people.
Yeah. The insurance companies, when I was a kid, no, I'll say when I was 25 and I went out to get my first life insurance policy.
And this was in the 70s, correct?
Correct. In the 70s, the policy said, this does not cover any kind of mental conditions. Couldn't get anything.
It's insane to think about that, like, how little regard there is for the whole human being.
You can get all the help you need if for a heart attack. Even if you're destitute, you can go to an emergency room and they will take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such help for mental illness.
Something that makes me think about too is the way that mental health has been approached over the years. And I can't speak to historic institutions where people were able to go for be admitted, honestly, because I don't want to act like a lot of people went to these places voluntarily either. But, you know, people were treated, from what I understand, historically, in a lot of ways, like criminals for having mental health issues. You lock them up and you keep them away and you don't focus on rehabilitating them. You focus on keeping them out of public, right? Frankly, I would assume, and again, this is all my opinion. So anybody listening, this is rooted in the knowledge that I have and my personal experience with mental health and the system, is that you're basically creating the perfect storm of ways to perpetuate these issues as opposed to resolve them, because you're essentially saying, let's just throw, you know, a Band-Aid on this situation. And when it becomes too much, then, oh no, like, we'll wipe our hands of it because, like, there's nothing more we can do here. Instead of thinking through what you can do to fix the system, to make it more accessible and healing for people who are on these journeys, because your experience, Steve, is not unique. There are so many people who are dealing with this. You, unfortunately, experienced it at a time where the pace of technology and awareness of education around mental health were not what they are today. So I tremendously appreciate you coming forward with your story at your age, saying, I didn't have these resources and I'm seeing the problem still perpetuated. And what can we do to change that? Because we're just going to continue to watch this downfall by turning our heads to it. It's like there's just no Sorry, I'm rambling a little bit here because I'm very passionate and upset about it from a societal perspective. I feel like we're human beings, do better, you know?
You know, about 5 years ago, one of my group members, I don't know what she did, but she got thrown into a mental hospital. And she called me up and said, they've raped me. I need to get out of here. So I went down to see her in this mental institution. And oh, yes, they had attendants there. And maybe they had a psychiatrist somewhere. But this poor lady was convinced she'd been raped several times by inmates. Nobody would do anything. You know what they said? No, you haven't been. But the point should have been, if you believe you were, we've got to find out why you're thinking that way. But they didn't. She just wandered the halls every day, was afraid she was going to get raped again. So in my opinion, unless you're extremely lucky or extremely well off, and I was one of those who was well off, I could afford going to a psychiatric hospital when I went in.
The resources aren't there. And if they are there, to your point, I mean, because it sort of goes hand in hand too with like rehabilitation for drugs and alcohol, you hear a lot. And this is why I compared it to a prison, because prisons as well, these are for-profit places that are focused on getting what they intend to get out of it without actually caring about the result for the people who are there needing the help.
You said something a few minutes ago about the perpetrators of the assaults are mentally ill too. Our system says, if you're found guilty, you're going to jail. Now, wouldn't it be a little bit smarter if the really bad ones went to jail? I mean, there's nothing you can do with them. But the majority of those people who are convicted are so much in need of mental care that throwing them in the jail is going to worsen the problem.
Sure.
But that's what they do.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious in the experiences that you've had. You've been very open, and I appreciate this so much, Steve, sharing your experience going through a sexual assault at a really young age, and then having a lot of interactions with people who have been victims of sexual assault as well. Is that something that has been or is challenging for you, having gone through that in your own right and then having other people share those stories with you? Because there were sequences of events that happened in my last relationship where my ex had shared with me that she had been sexually assaulted previously, without going in like too far down the rabbit hole in this conversation. There was a moment where something happened and it appeared that she may have been sexually assaulted again. And for me, for a really long time, talking about it, the reason I know the stats that I know is because I went like so far into the, how do I advocate? How do I change this? What can I do? And then it felt like too big of a problem to solve. I don't know how to deal with this. And then I sort of had to step away so I could regain my sense of safety in my body. But when it came back around and I was able to kind of move forward from that a little bit, it was really triggering for me to hear people talk about sexual assault or rape. And it was something that I think it's triggering no matter what, if you have a close connection to it, in my experience, but I'm curious if you feel that way as well.
Well, I would say no. I never thought of it for 20 years, but let me tell you what happened. I got up the guts to tell my psychiatrist, this is about 5 or 10 years after I started to go see him, and I'd gotten over the worst of my problems. But I thought, today I'm going to tell him about my sexual assault. So I got all my guts up, and I said, I want to tell you, I was sexually assaulted when I was 9. His reaction was, so how are you today? Well, I'm fine, but did you hear what I said? He says, that's okay. You're okay today. And he wouldn't delve into what had happened to me.
That's interesting.
Didn't pay any attention to it. And about 5 years later, he was dead. And I went to a psychologist who was a friend of mine, an acquaintance, very good friend. And I'm in her office and I said, I want you to know I was sexually assaulted and this is something that I think we got to deal with. And she said, well, what'd the other psychiatrists say? I said, nothing. She said, well, that's the way it is. So my feeling is that you can not always depend on the professionals to give you what you need. So often in my groups, I hear people quitting going to a therapist, psychiatrist, whatever, because they couldn't connect with them. The psychiatrist wouldn't listen to what they were saying. They were already on a plan of how to treat them because they treated everybody else the same way.
I love that you just said that, Steve. I need to interject and I will let you finish what you're saying, but that you just hit the nail on the head. And I think this is a big part of why a lot of people stop going to see therapists or don't want to go, because they fear what you're describing, or they've experienced what you're describing and they feel like a lost cause, or like, then they're telling me it's nothing, it's not anything. And the term that you use is that they don't connect with somebody, and it's just so spot on. You need to feel safe and you need to feel like you're getting what you need, and getting what you need in terms of validation. You're not looking for somebody, you don't want somebody who's just going to tell you you're right all the time, but you want somebody who justifies that your feelings are valid and that your experience is valid.
Correct. And I tell you, all the time I'm telling my group members, stand up for yourself. Tell the psychiatrist that you're not feeling well, the medication is not working, and advocate for yourself to get something better. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, because these people, especially the ones on the lower end of the economic scale, have just been beaten to death on their problems. And they quit taking the medication because it doesn't work all right away. Or many of them say, well, I took the medication, I felt well, so I decided to stop it. I didn't need it anymore. They went back into the toilet. And so many of them say, I'm not going to take any drugs at any time. So it's a combination of themselves ruining their chances to be better and not being able to connect with a professional who can really help them.
Yeah, and you make an interesting point that I think a lot of people probably need to hear. Whether you are someone who deals with mental health issues and takes medication, or you're somebody who doesn't deal with it and you wouldn't understand because of that. I have gone through moments in my life where I did exactly what you described. I'm feeling better. Like, I don't need to take this anymore. That's not how it works. You feel better because you're taking it. Now, if you work with your psychiatrist, there might be points in time where you can reduce or change your what medications you're taking, and you can taper off of them. In a lot of cases, you don't want to quit cold turkey, but you need to work with the professionals that you're seeing to help you understand which way you need to do that. Because if you just quit your medication cold turkey, you actually end up with like a lot of withdrawal symptoms, which are really terrible. I've actually forgotten to take my anti-anxiety medication. I'm on a pretty low dose. And for, let's say, like a few days or something, I have ADHD. So the struggle with that is like, I'll forget to take it. And then it's just, I've unintentionally done this to myself. And I know, because I start to feel those symptoms and I recognize that that's not okay. And so a big part of it too, to your point, Steve, is like listening to yourself, not just what you're telling yourself, but what you're physically feeling, and if you are not okay, and you do need to advocate for yourself. I think that's a really brilliant point, because I think we do rely a lot on professional insight to guide where we go with our mental health journey, but nobody, in a lot of ways, nobody knows you better than you. So you have to, provided you are in a well enough mental state to make certain decisions, to advocate for yourself, or if you feel like you're not in a good mental state, know when to reach out for help. And that you had mentioned, I think when we previously spoke, it's not something that you can do on your own, and it is not a burden to other people to ask for help.
One of the things that I'm up against when I have my groups and when people call me and ask me what to do is that they don't realize this is a lifelong battle to beat this. That's not fair, because you can't beat it. You've got to be able to make it so that you can cope with it and live a good life, which you can, which happened to me. How many years did it take? 35. So my life since 2000 has been great. Not perfect, but great. And I am of the belief that anybody who suffers mental health problems can still get a lot of enjoyment out of life if they will follow the path that their professional puts them on. And if it doesn't work, question that professional, because it's your life, it's not his. If something happens to you, he'll be upset, but it isn't going to change his life. Your life is the one that's changed. So I find that as really tough to deal with as more and more people give up.
Yeah. You probably are speaking a lot of truth for listeners, I imagine, with that sense of personal accountability and knowing that you sometimes need to question things. It's hard. I think we often imagine, or maybe not imagine, we think of mental health care professionals, or any healthcare professional, really, you know, they're the expert, they understand, they know. And so we sort of idealize their perspectives. And the reality is that they're also human. They are also flawed beings, as intelligent as they might be, as accredited as they might be. I mean, I had my ex and I were working with a couples therapist who then ultimately became her individual therapist as well. There were lots of like ethical lines crossed in all of this, and did trauma therapy for the both of us after that sexual assault scenario that I had described. And the thing that I recognized was this person had areas of expertise that were helpful. She does EMDR therapy and she did it very effectively, and that was helpful for me. But this person also sided with my abusive ex after she violently assaulted me and wrote a letter of recognizance to get her out of jail after the assault, citing me as the abuser. And like having that recognition, thinking I trusted this person, I felt the benefits of this person's practice and how they helped me through my trauma with this therapy. And when you feel like somebody that you've trusted with so much of your deepest personal thoughts and feelings has abandoned you, that is not a light feeling to have. That's something that you simultaneously have to cope with. There's a grieving process when you feel like you're not getting what you need from a professional, or like they have left you sort of hanging out to dry. And I think, you know, the situation I described is, I think, pretty specific, but, you know, I think there are a lot of therapists out there or psychologists similar to what you said, where it's like, oh, that's not a thing. You don't need to pay attention to that. Your problems aren't real. That's not a big deal. And I'm really curious, after those two scenarios where you mentioned it to each of these people and they sort of said, well, that is what it is, did you bring it up again to another professional that did validate it?
Not until I went to a trauma therapist about 5 years ago. As I said, at that time, I was doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. But I still had some stuff I had to get over.
Did it feel like a nagging? Like you kind of, like, it sounds like you brought it up a second time because you were thinking, I know this is something that I need to navigate.
Mm-hmm. The bigger issue that I went to the trauma therapist before was a long ago love interest that I couldn't get over. The sexual abuse was second.
Okay.
She fixed both of those problems just through listening, just not telling me what to do. She had me start writing down the chronological areas of my life from the sexual assault all the way through until that time. We discussed everything, and with her, probably like what would have happened if those two idiots would have challenged me on what I was saying, she was able to put everything into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And all the wasted time thinking about that lady went away. So, you know, in my case, my suffering was prolonged because I had two bad therapists.
Mm-hmm.
And the first therapist had been with me for 12, 15 years when he did that. So you never know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't fight back and say, what the hell are you talking about? I just let it slide. Because I found out that one of the things most of us suffer through is that we feel so inferior to people at many times that we won't challenge them. We know they're better than us, and we know that they're right on everything, and we're always wrong.
Yeah.
So it took me, well, let's see, that I would have been about 70. There's 42 years.
You know, better late than never, though, Steve. I really appreciate how you've committed to your journey and to your healing throughout all of this. And it really culminates in the book that you wrote, right? Where you took your experiences and you said to yourself, I need to share this, but also I can help by sharing this. So can you share with listeners a little bit about sort of what the process of writing your book was like? Because you just said, you know, you had to go through the chronological events and things like that in therapy. Was that a bit of a catalyst for you getting to the point where you wrote the book as well?
Yes. It is exactly what had me write the book. And one of the things about making it easier for me to write the book was because I had everything in chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what I was going to do to talk about in the book. I knew every incident in my mind. So what became a job for most book writers of getting all the facts and information, I didn't have to go through any of that. Mm-hmm. I had it all. And the big deal was writing it in a way that people would like it. And I think I accomplished that. It is a very good, straightforward book. The writing of it took not full time. I'm retired, and I was retired when I started writing the book. A couple hours a day, just about every day, took about a year. The process gets bogged down when you go to get it published. And that took another 2 years.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult and can be very expensive if you can't get a traditional publisher to take on the book, because it is a very narrow genre, specifically depression and bipolar. You know, there are not a lot of people who think about reading anything like that. So
yeah.
It's a tough book to get out in the public, but we're working on it.
The thing that I feel is so valuable about you sharing this story and sharing your memoir is that it will help inform people who are in similar situations that you've found yourself, but then also people who don't know about it. Like, this is an opportunity for them to try to understand more. And in my experience through life, and especially with this show, is that one of the best things that we can do is listen to other people's stories, even if we cannot relate to them, especially if we cannot relate to them, because it gives a sense of compassion and empathy that's required to be able to facilitate understanding, to allow us to have these hard conversations, to discuss topics that are difficult to discuss. You're so candid and just rich with knowledge of your own experience, but you've translated that into something that can help other people. So I really encourage anybody who's listening, I'll have the link in the show notes. You can also visit Steve's website, but his book is an opportunity to learn, to understand, and to engage with either part of your life that affects you or somebody that you love, or if you don't know anybody or you're not personally affected by mental health issues or bipolar disorder in particular, then take this opportunity to tune in and read about what this experience can be like for people and to grow that empathy within you, because we have to open our minds to other people's experiences to build a more collaborative, communicative, and compassionate society. That's really what this is about.
That is very true. I have an obstacle in getting my book out there because of the stigma against mental illness. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to beat down that stigma. Two things I try to do: give the people who are suffering the realization that they can live a good life, even though they've got bipolar or clinical depression or schizophrenia. They can all lead a better life. And two, to wipe out the stigma that is actually perpetuating the fact that we have such a poor response from the government, the insurance companies, the medical profession. We're just at the bottom of the heap when it comes to getting the help we need.
Yeah, we're trying to hold those institutions accountable for what they claim to provide in terms of resources and assistance. And I feel extremely driven to help share that message from, you know, your experience, the experiences that others have shared with me, my own experience. I feel like there is a much higher likelihood that this continues onward if we don't start to facilitate real meaningful change in these industries. And something that I do hold on to hope with is that there is more emphasis on emotional safety, psychological safety, mental well-being for younger generations now. And my hope is that there will be a turning point for them sometime soon. But as you said, I think that requires a much larger systemic shift, and that doesn't feel imminent. And I hate that. It's one of those things where it's like, the problem is so big that it feels a little bit like, where do you start? But the reality is we have to start somewhere. So any difference that you can make, try to make it. And there is power in numbers. And I do believe that this conversation is one that will help listeners and impact them in a way that translates into, just at the very least, as I said, more empathy. But maybe, you know, somebody listening will hear this and buy your book or share your story, or maybe it's somebody who works in one of these industries that can, you know, have a little bit of a light bulb go off in their head and think about how they can change something. That's always my desire when I'm having conversations like this, especially the ones that are just so deeply rooted in a lifelong journey of self-discovery and recognition of who you are. And Steve, I'm so grateful to have had you on here. And as we're rounding out the episode, is there anything else that you'd like to share with listeners before we hop off, either about your experience or anything?
One thing we haven't talked about.
No, please go for it.
Own personal support group.
Yes.
Now, in 1958, I didn't know better. I didn't tell anybody. But today, there's enough information out there that we should be able to, anybody who is suffering should be able to realize that mentally something is going awry. You need a support group in your life to help you get through this. You need parents who, they don't have to understand what you're going through. They just have to be sympathetic and try to show you love and respect and get you the help you need. So many of these kids that are now going through these problems don't share it with enough people. Now, you got to pick the people you want to share it with. You can't share it to everybody.
And sometimes that's not your parents, to your point. I mean, ideally, your parents can be supportive figures in your life, but there are a lot of parents who aren't equipped for that. And so if not your parents, then trusted individuals in your life that you can lean on.
One of the things that I was so upset about learning, it was about 10 or 12 years ago, I talked at a very prestigious high school and junior high out here in Phoenix. And this class I was talking to, I talked to every one of their classes for a full day. When we got all done, first of all, the teacher didn't like my speech at all. She thought it was too scary. Because it was. It's very down to the point.
It talks about, it is scary, but that's the point. Everything.
And then I said, well, how often do you have these sessions with your kids? She says, once a year. And I say, well, you know, that's not even close to enough. She says, well, we don't want to scare them. So I began to realize the incompetency in most of the teachers and counselors because they don't know what to do. Nobody's guiding them. Now it's getting better. I will say that. But this was from a very knowledgeable teacher, and she should have known better.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of when my sister was in middle school. I think she was in eighth grade, so maybe probably like 14, 15, these kids were. And a kid in her class killed himself. He shot himself. And he, I guess, had been writing things in class assignments or something that a teacher had access to at that point. This was pre-digital, so I'm sure a notebook or something. And brought it to the guidance counselors and said that they were concerned. And the guidance counselors wrote it off as teenage angst. And that's not to place blame on them because it's not ultimately solely their responsibility. Obviously, there's plenty of people in that person's life who he needed help from. But to that end, it echoes what you're saying and that, yeah, you don't want to scare kids, but you also don't want people to grow up with the perception of the world that is not accurate. How do you keep yourself safe? How do you grow in a productive way if you don't understand reality?
It's very true. Very true. But I do fault the counselors because, and the teachers, because common sense.
And that's completely fair.
Tells you something is wrong. Do something.
Yeah, absolutely. I really admire your persistence with communicating your message and making sure that people understand that. And I wholeheartedly support the way that you approached that with that individual because they need to hear it. Sorry that it's scary for you, but that's also life. And you can't go around acting like these things aren't happening. And if you do act that way, then it, as you've said sort of throughout this episode, it perpetuates the problem if you just don't acknowledge it. And I really appreciate the message that you send and that you've shared throughout this conversation, Steve.
Thank you very much. I just want to keep trying to get the word out. The best way to do it is through podcasts. I will say that. And I've done many of them. But I find that one of the limiting podcasts available are on mental health. You know, if you want to go and talk to somebody about movies, you'll have a 10,000, maybe more podcasts you can go to. I was on a podcast finder, if you want to call them that. They had 60 to choose from.
Wow.
60. It just shows you that everywhere mental health is just not up to the times.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a big part of what I'm trying to do with the show too. And something that I've really acknowledged to myself and to others, either that I've been having as guests or looking to potentially guest on other shows, is that my message really is about the intersection of human connection, mental health, and gratitude. And there needs to be an emphasis on all of those things. As you said, having a support group, having people in your life that you can trust, people that you can count on, that is the human connection part of it. The mental health aspect of it is being aware of yourself, understanding what you can do and also what options that you have. Some of those are things that you are going to have to do for yourself. You can only do so much by yourself. And then you also need that connection. And the reason I feel so passionately that gratitude is a part of that is because the things that we are able to achieve with the help of others by discovering these parts of ourselves and healing them, I've had such a tremendous amount of gratitude for the people and the experiences in my life that have led me to where I am now. And something that you've spoken to also is the people who have stepped in and been able to help you throughout the years, and the way that you're able to help people who are in these groups that you're facilitating or going to these schools and talking to them. Like, there's an element of gratitude that comes from sharing the stories. And to me, that is really more than anything, like the healing part of it is obviously the ultimate goal, but to be able to look at it through a lens of appreciation rather than just shame or sadness when we've gone through horrible things, it, I think, is a great way to help us reframe those experiences and bring us a sense of peace when we need it.
True, true. I want to leave you with one thought for many, many people who need to share their life stories or parts of it or whatever, or they just need to know that they are not alone. One thing I didn't have when I was a lot younger were support groups. They had them if you were in a hospital setting or something like that. But today, there are great support groups in every city in the United States, I'm assuming, because I know I've talked to a lot of those places. You will get a feeling of support and an ease of loneliness that you might be suffering from just by attending these groups. They can do as much for you as any therapist can do. You actually need a combination of the two plus medication, but don't be afraid to go to support groups.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Steve. I think that's really important, especially because of what you said. There are a lot of limitations financially for people, or even just access to the care that they need. There are ways to find help, even in part, throughout the journey. And this is a really important part of your message too, is that you can find it. You just have to look for it, right? And so be willing to acknowledge what you need to acknowledge so you can get the help that you need.
The great place to look is just on your computer.
Yep. Google it.
Google it. They're out there. Put in the city you're in, the state you're in, and bam, they'll come up.
Yep. And I think in something that's helpful, especially, I mean, even just when I was searching for a therapist, is trying to narrow it by what specifically you're looking for in a lot of cases. So whether it's like bipolar support group or family member of someone with bipolar support group, things like that, where you can try to kind of narrow the focus and find something that's more tailored to what you need, as opposed to just thinking, well, this person's a therapist, they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Or this is a support group for people who have mental health issues, but it doesn't necessarily relate to the aspects of your life where you need guidance or support.
There's one problem with, I have found, my support groups. People are always contacting me to join my group. And I let anybody come who requests. But the best group size is 12 to 15. Anything bigger than that becomes too tough to get everybody connected in the 2-hour time limit we have.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems that that creates is that people come to my group who I've never had on the group before, and they participate because I usually don't let anybody not participate just because of the method I do. But they don't connect for whatever reason, and they don't come back. They don't give it a second shot. And I can tell you that's probably 40 or 50% of the people who come to my groups. They just walk away. And they got to give it more chance than that. You're not going to connect in a way. It's kind of like taking medication. If you take a pill one day and it doesn't work, you stop it. Well, that's what a lot of them do with support groups.
Yeah.
Got to take your time.
Yeah. You have to find the strength to be patient and allow yourself the opportunity to go through that process of healing, whether that's with a support group, with therapy, with medication, whatever it requires. It would be amazing if all these things could just, you know, be fixed overnight, but that's unfortunately not how it works. So I definitely agree with you, Steve. And this has just been such a wonderful conversation.
You're a great host.
Oh,
and I'll tell you why, because you've asked questions that are not clinical or deserve a rote answer. You've asked questions that stimulate the conversation in a way that people can understand.
Thank you so much.
Podcasts where they might as well not even do the podcast because they don't know how to do it.
Thank you so much. That's a huge compliment. I appreciate that. You have a really interesting, compelling, engaging story, and I'm so glad I was able to share the mic with you. And gang, if you want to learn more about Steve or purchase his book, you can visit authorstevewilson.com. I will also include links in the show notes for where you can get the book on Amazon and all that good stuff. But in the meantime, is there anywhere else, Steve, you'd like people to try to find you online? Facebook, Instagram, all those good things?
Well, I'll be glad to give them my email address.
Perfect.
If they even want to contact me, it's swilson.wilson@gmail.com.
Awesome.
If they want to reach out, they can. I guess that's all we got to talk about.
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty more, but I really appreciate your time, Steve. And gang, that's all for this episode of Who the Fuck. We'll catch you on the flip side.
Thanks for listening to Who the Fuck, and if you like what you hear, share the show with your friends, family, coworkers, or anyone else you think needs a healthy dose of introspection and raw authenticity. Feel free to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. It's always appreciated, and you can also visit whothefck.com to check out more content. Plus, you can follow me on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at whothefck_pod to keep up to date with what's new in my world and for exclusive bonus content. Catch you on the flip side.